Good morning. It is so good to be with you all this morning. I have missed you over these last 7 weeks of cluster worship, and I had the privilege of spending much of this weekend up at Camp Friedenswald at our not church retreat, Friedenswald Getaway, with other assembly folks who chose to stay at Friedenswald this morning. No judgment. I have been immersed in the world of Exodus for much of those last 7 weeks. I've been reading commentaries, listening to podcasts, watching Prince of Egypt, and of course, building tiny pyramids and burning bushes in my living room. Thank you all for putting up with my obsession with children's toy Bible reenactments. It really is my jam. But as fun as it is to tell these stories, my hope for this series is that these ancient texts are a starting point for engaged conversation around our current realities, and that these stories can somehow empower us to act for justice today. So we begin with a paranoid megalomaniac, desperately trying to maintain power at any cost, threatened by those on the margins, and trying to demonize them and keep them oppressed. And now let's turn to Exodus. All right, but seriously. Pharaoh is concerned that the Hebrew people are growing too large in number, and so he tries to limit their growth by enslaving them and wearing them down, building cities and doing hard labor. As a side note here, it pains me to tell you that they were likely not building pyramids. This myth gained popularity in the movie The Ten Commandments, but the idea of the Israelites building the pyramids is simply not true. Thank you to my co-pastor Scott for disabusing me of that notion. I did not know it, which is why in the children's movies, the Israelites are not building the pyramids, but simply doing deferred maintenance on them. Anyway, when the hard labor does not curb the population growth, Pharaoh hatches an evil plan, commanding the midwives to kill the boys as soon as they are born. Now, obviously, this was a flawed idea. You don't ask people who are in the business of bringing life to be harbingers of death. I spoke with a labor and delivery nurse in our congregation who said that there is no way that women who have just spent the last 10-plus hours encouraging and coaxing and welcoming new life into the world would ever take that life. Labor, especially then, was so risky. For mothers and newborns, there's no way that at the end of that, the midwives would be willing to take that life. And so the women boldly defy Pharaoh's orders. And so we are introduced to these women, these two courageous women named Shiphrah and Puah. This is a big deal that they are named in the text. Lots of women aren't, and they have a short but very important role to play in the story. Womanist theologian Will Gaffney engages in some midrash around this text. I made her commentary available earlier this week in the prayer and sharing, and I hope some of you had a chance to read it. She imagines Shiphrah and Puah gathering all of the midwives together. For surely the two of them are not the only midwives for all the Hebrew people. Rather, she imagines them as leaders of the midwifery guild. And so all these women come together and they organize and they plan and they swap birthing stories and anecdotes. And Puah says, "Trust in whose name is holy. This is what we shall do. Deliver the babies. Hide as many of the boys as you can. Raise others as girls. Do not worry about the Egyptians. They cannot imagine that we would defy the Pharaoh whom they revere as a living God." And so, in the tradition of women working together for justice, the babies are saved. And the Hebrew population continues to grow. When Shiphrah and Puah are called before Pharaoh again, they deceive him by playing on his own racialized stereotypes. The Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are too vigorous, almost like wild animals. The babies just plop out of them before they can arrive. Neil Elliott observes, "Their sly answer reflects the cunning on which subjected people must often rely as they navigate the treacherous ways of an oppressive culture." And they did so because they feared God, this ancient God that Jacob and Joseph and his brothers brought with them to Egypt. God hasn't been that active over the past several generations, but God's people have certainly become numerous, just as God promised Abraham and Sarah. And some of them, at least, have continued to be faithful to the God of their ancestors. We are told that because of their faithfulness, God blesses Shifra and Pua with families of their own. Now, at this point, the text zooms in on one particular family, one particular mother and baby. The third courageous woman we meet is Jochebed. She's not named here in Exodus 2, but we know that she is from the house of Levi. As you heard in the Reader's Theater today that Merritt wrote, that's an important detail, because Levi is the tribe of priests. So this is just a little heads up to the reader that this baby is going to have a priestly role in some way. It's a little foreshadowing to the reader. And Jochebed sees that this is a fine baby. But actually, the Hebrew word is tov, good. Just like God in creation, Jochebed sees and acknowledges that her creation is tov. It is good. We don't know if it's Shifra and Pua who deliver him, but we can assume that whoever it was encouraged her to be proactive, make a plan to keep him safe. She hides him for a bit, but as all parents know, you cannot keep a baby quiet for long, and so she hatches a plan to float him down the river. The Reader's Theater today suggested that Jochebed's plan was to use the river during the day as a place to hide her son and then retrieve him again at nighttime. I did not read that in any of the commentaries I found, but I do kind of like that idea. Rather than just sending him down the river and trusting him, she plans to come retrieve him again. One lovely linguistic detail to note here is that the Hebrew word used for the basket is teva. And this is the same word that is used for the ark, Noah's ark. It's found only in these two places. The teva is a floating salvation vessel, which is a clue that Jochebed is not acting just on her own. She's a part of God's bigger plans for saving all people. Her dreams align with God's dreams for the preservation of life, particularly the lives that are most vulnerable. Our fourth courageous woman is Miriam, who watches over her brother. Like Jochebed, she's not named in this chapter, but we find out later that Moses' older sister is named Miriam. She's instructed to stand at a distance and see what happens to him. Miriam is a prophet, and it is her song that we will hear later, spoiler alert, after the people cross the Sea of Reeds to safety and salvation. And it is her quick thinking in this chapter to approach Pharaoh's daughter and offer her mother as a wet nurse. This buys Jochebed some more time with her son and allows her to have some influence on who her son will become. So now we've arrived at woman number 5, Pharaoh's daughter, who does not have a name in the text. While she is bathing down by the river, she sees something strange. She opens the basket, and surprise, it's a crying Hebrew baby. She takes pity on him. She knows what he is, and she knows her father's edict. But she decides to save this baby, even enlisting the help of his sister and mother to be a wet nurse for him until he is weaned and returned to her. And she names him Moses, because, as we heard, she drew him out of the water, the Hebrew verb mashah. Now, there are questions about this, if you listen to the podcast I sent out this week, because why would Pharaoh's daughter speak Hebrew, which was the language of the slaves? And why, if she's trying to protect his identity, would she give him a Hebrew name? Peter Enns quips that you don't name your child Moshe if you're trying to pass as an Egyptian. But Moses is also an Egyptian name. Oh, wait. It's related to other common Egyptian names like Amenmoses, Ramesses, Tutmosis. It means born of. Often it goes with another word preceding it. But this one is just Moses. So his name is Hebrew and Egyptian, and it allows him to code switch, to function in both Egyptian culture and Hebrew culture. Why did Pharaoh's daughter act to save this baby? And how do we tell her story? Is she also a courageous woman defying authority? Yes. And it's a little more complicated than that. Just as a thought experiment, I tried to imagine Ivanka Trump adopting a child separated from his parents at the border, raising him in her household, naming him, protecting him. Is this subversive? Is it courageous? Is it supporting and upholding the evil systems of oppression? Yeah. Will Gaffney imagines Pharaoh's daughter as an ally to the Hebrew people, someone who uses her privilege to work for justice on behalf of oppressed people. But allyship has its limits. She does not work to dismantle her own privilege. She just brings Moses into that world. Gaffney imagines Pharaoh's daughter and Jochebed, Moses' mother, conspiring to give Moshe a rich bicultural formation in both heritages, believing that his access to privilege could one day be used in service to his people. I like the idea of them working together. Because of what Pharaoh's daughter does, the Hebrew people are saved. So I think we do lift up this story. And I think we ought to be a little disturbed by it. And ask ourselves, what are the ways that we are upholding systems of evil and maintaining privilege, even as we act on behalf of individuals within the system? So we have these five women working in tandem with God's dreams to liberate the people. Pharaoh has been concerned that the Hebrew people would rise up against him, and so he's attempted to kill all the males. But of course, the irony is that, like many paranoid and power-hungry leaders, Pharaoh is threatened by the wrong things. "Kill the boys," he says twice, "but the girls can live." Nadia Boltz-Weber writes, "Because what threat could girls be? Well, don't look now, Pharaoh, but five of them are coming for you. A Hebrew mother, her daughter, your own daughter, and two midwives. See, Pharaoh underestimated the power of pissed-off women who care about justice and want to protect the weak and guard the innocent." I like Nadia Boltz-Weber. Pete Enns makes the point that this is hardly feminist propaganda from the writer of Exodus, although we can totally lift it up as such. More likely, though, this is about showing that the most powerful man in Egypt is bested by those without traditional power, women who God works through to save and redeem. Now, it is eventually Moses and Aaron who lead the people out of Egypt, so it's not that men aren't active participants in this story. But to be fair, as we'll hear next week, God really has to twist Moses' arm to be a participant in God's saving work. He is reluctant. He is worried. He is slow of speech. He begs God, "Please, send someone else." And I wondered, why did God choose someone so hapless? Is Moses really that great of a choice? And yet, Moses, because of his bilingual, multi-mothered, third culture kid upbringing, was uniquely qualified to speak to the Israelites and to Pharaoh. Moses was the man for the job because he was a cultural bridge. Thanks entirely to the women who risked their lives to imagine a different future for him and gave him the cultural tools to move between Egyptian and Hebrew spaces. A few years ago, I read Trevor Noah's book, Born a Crime, and I was struck by the courage and imagination of his mother. She was black, and she had a child with a man who was white, which was a crime in South Africa at that time. Trevor Noah describes his unusual upbringing and the ways that his mother was committed to exposing him to lots of different things. He writes, "People thought my mom was crazy. Ice rinks and drive-ins, suburbs, these things were Izintu Zabalungu, the things of white people. So many people had internalized the logic of apartheid and made it their own. Why teach a black child white things? Neighbors and relatives used to pester my mom. Why do this? Why show him the world when he's never going to leave the ghetto? Because, she would say, even if he never leaves the ghetto, he will know that the ghetto is not the world. If that is all I accomplish, I've done enough." Trevor's mother, Patricia Noah, gave her biracial son the imagination and the cultural tools to move between worlds at a time when there weren't two worlds to him to legally move between. She acted as if the future, that is, the end of apartheid, already existed, at great risk. And now Trevor has this incredible platform on The Daily Show to be able to speak to what is happening in the United States. I'm not saying Trevor Noah is Moses, but he is pretty great. And the imagination and courage his mother gave him this incredible gift to speak prophetically and with humor in many different places to many different people. Trevor's mother had no evidence that apartheid would end. And yet she acted in the certainty that it could. She was willing to risk her life to give her son the opportunities to thrive in a world that did not yet exist. Walter Brueggemann calls this the prophetic imagination. He writes, "It is the vocation of the prophet to keep alive the ministry of imagination, to keep on conjuring and proposing futures alternative to the single one that the king wants to urge as the only thinkable one." Shifra and Pua, Miriam and Jochebed, Pharaoh's daughter and Patricia Noah. Each of these women knew evil when they saw it and refused to participate in it. They knew that the world as it was not what it could be. By working together, not as individuals, but as sisters for justice, they were a part of God's dreams for liberation. May these courageous women inspire us to bold action. May we defy authority when we are commanded to be used as instruments of death. May we raise our children to be able to move between cultures so that they are equipped to create and participate in a more equitable tomorrow. May we, as privilege, act on behalf of those who are oppressed and also do the hard work of dismantling that privilege, not simply offering help while holding tightly to power. And may we actively engage in the ministry of prophetic imagination, dreaming and acting for the future that is not yet, but can be if we act as though it is coming. May it be so. Amen.